I'd like to go ahead and bring the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today is it's 1 minute after 9 a.m., January 23rd, 2023. With me today is Co-Chair Hoffman, Co-Chair Olson, Senator Merrick, and myself, Stedman. We'll be joined by other senators here shortly, I think. Today, we're going to talk about savings, reserves, and investment funds with the Department of Revenue. This will be one of several hearings over the next couple of months as we delve into the subject of our cash flow and trying to lay that out the next two or three years, because there is some concerns that we do not run short and have difficulty in meeting our payroll obligations and our obligations to the citizens to pay a dividend. They're both significant issues. Not necessarily in that order, by the way. So today, we have asked Commissioner Designee Adam Crum to come forward and the Treasury Director Pam Leary. And if they could go ahead and come forward. We've been joined by Senator Keel. With that, go ahead and introduce yourself, Designee Crum, and then when comes time for Deputy Director Pam Leary, maybe she can give the public a little bit of background about herself, how long she's worked for the department and the state. Mr. Crum, you can avoid that because you did that last time.
Thank you, Senator and Mr. Chair. For the record, Adam Crum, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Revenue. Thank you for having us here again today. So with me is Treasury Division Director Pam Leary, who's got, I think the number we set on was over 15 years of experience with the department and an extensive background upon which she'll go into further detail. So the presentation we're going to give today, as you said, sir, is very important because it talks about our cash management, our cash flow issues with the state on how we can maintain our ongoing operations. And so look forward to the discussion today and ongoing throughout the rest of the session.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Pam Leary. I am the director of the Treasury Division. I have been with the Treasury for 15 years. Prior to that, I was with PricewaterhouseCoopers as a partner in the New York office before I saw the light and moved to Alaska. And I've been here for 20 years now. I am a CPA, and I'm excited to be able to present our presentation today to Senate Finance, and thank you for having us.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
So there are three items on the agenda today. First, I thought I'd give a little bit of background on the Treasury and what we do, and then we'll talk about the state funds that we manage, and we'll also talk about state cash flows in the process. Slide three shows the four main sections of the Treasury, which we will get into a little bit further on. On slide four, there are some statistics about the Treasury. We have 45 positions. Currently, we have six vacancies. Most of our staff touch investments in some capacity via portfolio management, accounting, operations, compliance, debt management, etc. We currently have near $47 billion in assets under management, and we call that AUM sometimes, so if you hear that, that's what that means. We have a combined operating budget of $15.3 million, and the division is a resource to many, many different constituents, including all of our agencies and the public.
So can you help you're done with this slide?
Yeah.
Okay. Could you help the public with the $46.8 billion? Is that included or excluded dealing with the permanent funds, roughly 70 some odd billion, right, south of 80
that
billion.
Is separate from the permanent fund corporation, so just within the Treasury, and I'll elaborate on the next page what that includes.
Okay. Go ahead.
So slides five and six talk a little bit about investment management, and here we see the breakout of that $47 billion into 47 separate accounts. There are 18 funds that the Alaska Retirement Management or Board or ARM Board is the fiduciary of, and then there are 25 funds under the direction of the Commissioner of Revenue, and that's $8.2 billion. We also have four funds that are under the direction of other fiduciaries, including EVOS, Mental Health Trust, and Alaska Student Loan Corp. So the accounts that we manage are managed in a pooled environment, which is really efficient and cost effective. You can see that the asset classes that the ARM board funds roll into, there are seven of them, and those are listed there. But there are 23 investment pools that roll up into those seven asset classes. And there are nine pools that states can invest in. And if you think about any of our investment mandates or external managers or internal managers, those roll up into the pools, and those pools roll up into the asset classes, and that's what the funds invest in. Slide six shows a little bit about the process of investment management. The chief investment officer and staff meet with the fiduciaries to determine what those asset classes are. They look at what the fund is used for, how long the fund is expected to be invested, and what types of risk appetite each of the funds have. They utilize capital markets, both from Callan, the consultant, and other industry data, and they build models to generate potential asset allocation targets. They work with the fiduciaries to determine what those are, and then they invest. So we have meetings with both the ARM board and the State Investment Review. Both have an independent investment advisory committee. Summaries of the materials for those meetings are publicly available on the website. And so during those meetings, they review performance, the asset allocation, the policies, et cetera. And many managers and other consultants also present at these meetings. So there's a vast bit of information that's provided.
Okay, go ahead.
Slide seven is the cash management group, which unless you deal with them, they kind of just do their work under the radar. You don't know that they're there most of the time, but it's a huge function of the Treasury. All of the state cash goes in and out of the general fund proper, and we'll talk a little bit more about that process towards the end of the presentation. They also manage many of the state contracts with the banks, including credit card acceptance, the ACH, which is the direct deposit accounts, and warrant clearing accounts, et cetera. Often they consult with the departments on their banking service needs to make sure that their needs are met. Slide eight discusses debt management, which implements the directives from the Commissioner's Office and the State Bond Committee. As many of you know, the prior debt manager, Devin Mitchell, has moved on to the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. He is replaced by longtime finance manager, Ryan Williams, and I'm sure he will be providing presentations to Senate Finance and other committees throughout the session. They, as part of debt management, they conduct meetings with rating agencies. They provide information for all of the statutorily required reporting for, like, the revenue sources book, the annual comprehensive financial report, and they publish towards the end of this month the debt book and the affordability analysis. The debt management group also provides leadership and staff for the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority, and so they spend half their time doing debt management for the state and half the time with the bond bank. Moving on to slide nine, unclaimed property. This is what I call one of our fund divisions, fund groups. They collect money from various holders, whether it's banks or insurance companies or utilities or employers, that has been left behind by individuals, and it's where all of that data comes and money comes in a centralized place where people can look up whether they have any money that's owed to them from, I don't know, maybe they forgot their last paycheck and it's been hanging out and they never got it. And so they can put in their name into a database to see if money is owed, and I encourage everybody to do that. You can go to unclaimedproperty.alaska.gov to see if you are, in fact, owed any money. And the Unclaimed Property Division spends a lot of time going through this data, reuniting owners with their property, and promoting unclaimed property And the current tally is there's $1.8 claimable properties with a value of $258 million currently available to Alaskans.
And is there, can you just briefly give us a time limit on it?
There actually is no time limit. Anytime a claimant has money that's due to them, they get that money.
Okay, so the money that was put in there in territorial days, is it still in there?
We take a portion of the funds, and I'll get into this a little bit later, of the money that comes in and put it to the general fund because we know that not all money will be claimed.
Okay.
So I'll have some more statistics on that in the next few slides. Slides 10 and 11, we're talking a little bit about the Treasury accomplishments. I'm always proud that we have such a great group in our Treasury division. There are many professional designations, certified public accountants like myself, chartered financial analysts, investment performance measurement certifications, as well as Treasury certifications. And there's a lot of education that goes on and continuing education for all of our staff. In terms of performance results, fiscal year 22, both PERS and TERS had negative 4.1%. But that does not diminish the fact that we have had 9% returns in the 38-year history of the retirement systems. And really, over the last 10 years, these systems have outperformed their benchmark by 126 basis points and outperformed over 85% of peer plans. So they're in the top quartile, which is great. Also, state assets have grown by 9% in the last year, also largely performing, outperforming their fund benchmarks. And I have in the past discussed how we have moved some of our external managed funds internally and that are managed by our in-house investment officers, and that continues to have result in $35 million in annual savings from free reductions.
So you can help me with what you're saying here. So what's a basis point?
Do I have basis points in here?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, I do. I have 126 basis points. Basis point is 1/100 of a percent. And so if you think about it, it's like 0.0001 is one basis point.
So when you tell me that you're 126 basis points above some number, that is, what are you telling me?
That means that it is 1.2% more than what would be in the public market sector, which is the benchmark that we use.
And then just briefly, why do you compare it against benchmark versus zero?
Well, the benchmark represents if we had publicly traded or just put the money into a public fund, like an S&P or whatever the equivalent is to the various asset classes that we manage. And so showing that we are performing above the benchmark shows that our active performance is better than just putting your money into a money market, a public equity fund, et cetera.
All right. So those are your component targets.
Yes. And each asset class that we have has a specific benchmark.
Right. So we want to remember, we want to, somebody that's never seen a finance committee before, we want them to follow what you're saying.
Absolutely. Thank you for the question.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are the investment officers here explain on the slide, just in terms of certifications, are they all up to that type of certification level?
For the investment officers,
yes.
They are either at that level or working towards it. We have some newer staff that are working towards it, and it takes about 4 years to get that designation. There are three very long tests. And I think the percentage of passing each one is around 50%. So they're very difficult tests, and it does take some time 4 years is pretty much the minimum.
That's a subcommittee question also. Senator Wilson has given you a quick peekaboo of some of the subjects we'll be working on in the subcommittee, personnel issues. Are there questions on this slide? Next slide, please.
So we're going to talk a little bit about the debt and unclaimed property accomplishments. There has been an increase in the state's credit rating outlook by Fitch and Standard & Poor's as of the spring this past year. S&P revised from stable to positive, and Fitch revised from negative to stable. And I believe we're looking forward to new affirmations from the rating agencies pretty soon in the next few weeks or so. There has been some savings by investing through the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank, where the bond bank has a credit rating that often is better than some municipalities. So the bond bank will issue bonds and then issue additional bonds so that there are savings for different municipalities when they borrow the money from the bond bank. That resulted in $55.4 million in savings over the past two fiscal years. And there was also a restructuring of the outstanding debt of the airport system. That saved $81.8 million in future debt service payments. Over the last few years, we've also transformed how unclaimed property does its business. And we've been able to, through doing so, maintaining a reduced claims backlog, despite an increase of 15% in claims being received, and we think this is really good. We have holdings that are increasing. There's been a lot of outreach to holders, and we're going to continue that process. We're also reaching out to potential claimants for some of the tangible property that we have. For fiscal year 22, we returned approximately $13.5 million to Alaskan owners. We transferred $12 million into the state general fund and had an increase of 16% in holdings that have come in. So that's great. Since 2019, that number is $90.9 million that we've received in unclaimed property, $45 million transferred to the state general fund, and over $34 million returned to claimants.
Okay. And just a quick comment question on the third bullet point. On the one of the issues we've run into when we've seen some of our communities restructure their debt, reissue outstanding debt on fiscal assets, that they stretch the amortization out and they never pay off their fiscal asset. So on the, do you know offhand on the airport, $81 million in debt service payments, is that, did they stretch out the amortization and time, or is that just the same time frame of debt service payments and just a savings due to a decline in the interest rate? And if you don't know that, you can get back to me in probably excruciating detail.
Chair Stedman, I would be happy to get back to you on that topic, but it is the total savings is $81.8 million over time. I just don't know the time frame that the debt payments.
Right, and the concern is that we're not taking advantage of lower interest rates and continually stretching out our payments on our hard assets. We want to get them paid for so we can build new stuff. So,
I'd be happy to get back to you on that.
Okay, that'd be fine.
Thanks. So moving to slide 12, I'm going to pause here just to give you like a preview of what the slides on 13 through 24 will be. It's going to show the six of the funds that we invest on behalf of fiduciaries for. We're going to have two slides for each fund. The first is going to show the fiscal year balances historically, and the second will show statistics as of December 31st. Before we go into those, I thought I'd say a little bit about last year's market conditions, which were mostly not positive due to inflation and the dramatic increase in interest rates. And essentially, those led to material losses in almost every asset class. U.S. stocks were down by 19%, international equity by 16%, and the broad market fixed income was down 13%. And although our funds were down, all of the funds we manage had moderate outperformance compared to our benchmarks. And so those are just kind of general overall statements before we move into slide 13.
Go ahead. Are you done with 13?
I have not started on 13 yet.
Okay. Go ahead.
And we'll probably spend some time on this slide, I'm guessing. So the graph on slide 13 shows in blue what we call the main fund of the Constitutional Budget Fund, which was created in 1990. The yellow portion of the fund is the subfund of the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, which was created in 2000 for funds that weren't going to be used for 5 years and therefore could be invested to achieve higher returns. And we've included on this slide also in gray the Statutory Budget Reserve Fund, as these all three have been savings funds of the state, and it made most sense to include these. You can see that the high point was in 2014, about $17.6 billion in our savings funds, and has declined since then. The CBRF is funded through resolutions of disputes on mineral income. Appropriations can be made by simple majority vote if the amount available for appropriation is less than prior years. Otherwise, it's a three-quarters vote. All appropriations of the CBRF must be repaid. And that's in accordance with Constitution Section 17D. So the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund has been used for two main reasons. One is to fund temporary cash flow expense and revenue mismatches throughout a year, but it's also been used primarily to appropriate and cover budget revenue shortfalls. I think I'll pause there and see if you have any questions.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Leary, as I look at the bottom there in your CBR main fund, $0.91 billion, that seems to be somewhat different than what we were, or at least what I've been told, I think from legislative finance, that it's in excess of $2 billion. What's the reason for the discrepancy?
So I get into this concept a little bit later.
Okay.
But cash versus accrual, these are the actual cash balances that are invested mm-hmm. at the bank right now. What the $2+ billion is the number that will be available for appropriation once the final transfer from the general fund goes to the CBR. And so that number becomes known after the final audit of the ACFR, and that's produced. It's held fairly closely because there's lots of in and out through the audit process. And so that is the estimate of what the amount will be available for appropriation as of June 30 or July 1st of this fiscal year to spend.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I can continue, how do we convince the public that this is not funny money that's being considered here and in essence, imaginary money that's out there that's not available?
What I can tell you is that the Division of Finance has told me that is also the number that they're targeting for a transfer. And there are a variety of things that are composed of that number. Some of the amounts have to do with the sweep. And then there are other general transfer numbers that happen throughout the year for mineral deposits, et cetera. So I can tell you that it's, from everything that I've seen, that it's not funny money and that we expect a transfer to occur to the fund later when the ACFR is published.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So the $1.37 billion total in cash, that was the cash balance on 1st of July? 22, is that correct?
Yes, for the main fund, it's the point, or $910 million for the main fund. The additional money is what's in the SBR, that $460. So that's the total of the
So if you could get back to the committee, you know, we've got our financial statements underway, and we recognize here that that exercise isn't completed till some months after July 1st, sometimes 6-7 months after July 1st. So if you could just get back to the committee with a total, and you could break it down by the grouping here, would be probably easier for everybody. So taking your $1.37 billion and then what you expect the other billion roughly is going to comprise of for the committee.
Be happy to.
And I recognize there might be some estimates or some adjustments or what have you, but get it, you know, just you can put little footnotes on it if it makes you comfortable or whatever.
There definitely will be estimates and footnotes on that number because we don't even know what the number in the Department of Revenue is until the audit is finalized.
It's $1 billion, and a lot of times what we find here in the legislative process is some folks will get fixated on a particular numeric. Maybe it's just 1.37 when other presentations are 2.37. Where's the other $1 billion? So we'll get that data set, and that'll help alleviate that. Because we have a lot of new members in the building, and this is going to get a multi-layer onion full of confusion.
Understood. We'll try our best to be clear and concise. Yep.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the past, we've had a target of not to go below $500 million. Is there a target that the department specifies as a minimum balance to be held in the CBR?
You don't have to answer that. If you're not comfortable, then answer it incorrectly.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, that number has changed throughout the years. It has been as low, I think, as $500 million, as low as $1 billion, $2 billion. Those numbers throughout the variety of years have been discussed based on a variety of models that have happened. And I think the number changes based on the circumstance we find ourselves in the years, whether we're going to have a budget that's balanced or not, where the money is coming from to support the general fund and the CBR and the money that's in there. And it relies on looking towards the future to see what we're going to need those funds potentially for. So we don't have an answer right now as to what we believe that should be, but the number has varied half, $1 billion, $2 billion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So if I could add to that, it'd probably be beneficial because we've had numerous targets set by different governors and different OMB directors, ranging anywhere from upwards of the neighborhood of $3 billion down to $500 or even zero, and go to the permanent fund and have that cash flow us so we can basically spend the CBR. So if you could give that some thought and get back to the committee. We'll be asking the same question to the OMB director, so it'd be nice if the administration has a range or a number or what have you, so we could make payroll in a timely manner.
Of course.
Without going to the permanent fund.
We shall do that. Thank you.
Okay.
So slide 2 on the CBRF shows the statistics for the 12 months ending December 31st, 2022. At the top, you will see that we have a low risk tolerance because this fund needs to be fairly liquid in case money is needed from it with its current balance. It is invested 100% in cash equivalents, so money markets, treasury bills, corporation debt, muni debt, etc. The current cash balance before the transfers from the general fund for fiscal year 22 is $1.065 billion. That's as of December. The one-year return is 1.6% beating its benchmark of 1.46%. And you can see that the first half of fiscal year 23, that six-month number, is looking pretty good. And perhaps will beat the projected return of 2.39%. Okay. So we'll move on to slides 15 and 16. We'll talk about the Power Cost Equalization Fund. It was funded in 2000 by the sale of the Four Dam Pool Hydro Project and other transfers from the general fund in 2012 and 2017. And it's to provide for a long-term stable financing source for affordable levels of electric utility costs for areas that normally would have much higher costs. There is 5% of the monthly average market value of the fund for the three previous fiscal years that can be appropriated. And there's also availability to assist other funds, such as a community assistant fund and renewable energy grant funds, if prior year's earnings exceed that amount that is calculated.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you give the committee and the audience an idea of how that fund is doing regarding benchmarks? Are we above or below the benchmarks?
Yes, and I'll go into that on the next slide, which is a great segue. On slide 16, you can see that this is a fund that has a high risk tolerance now. Last session, legislation was passed that changed how the fund is invested. And as amended, it directs the Commissioner of Revenue to apply the prudent investor rule and invest the assets to consider preservation of the purchasing power of the fund and maximizing returns from income and appreciation. So there's a long investment horizon for this fund. There's a high risk tolerance again. It's about a 70-30 equity to bonds ratio in terms of its asset allocation in those highlighted classes of assets. And this compares to last year, which only had 56% in equity. It is at $957 million as of 12/31, and for the year ending December, it had a negative 14.95% loss, but it beat its benchmark, which was negative 15.2. Our projected 10-year return is 5.6% for this particular fund.
Has anybody ever not meant to benchmark? Everything seems to be hitting their benchmark. Is there any areas where the benchmark may not be met?
There definitely have been. So, I mean, and the benchmarks, especially for the state funds, tend to be like public markets. I would say that for our state funds, we have over 70% that are managed in-house. A lot of our fixed income investments are managed literally traded in-house by our investment officers. So the fact that they're beating their benchmark shows just how good a job that they're doing. But yes, they have in fact not met their benchmarks.
Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, I remember when the guideline was 7% and several years ago reduced that down to 5%. Last year, we went to the prudent investment rule. The concern that I have and the question that I have is that you look at years ending in 2018 through 2021, the fund under the 5% rule has been increasing without any reductions. But under the prudent investment rule, or whenever that kicked in during 21 to 22, the fund has lost $200 million. The question that I have is that should we as the committee, particularly those that are dependent upon this fund for the high electrical cost in rural Alaska, consider getting rid of the prudent investment rule and go back to the 5% rule, because I have concerns that this
the investment objective of high risk is very, very troubling. We as a state don't, rural legislators don't want to come back to the state of Alaska and ask for more funds. You go back to the history of the fund from the previous page, from the 2000, that was primarily funded from general funds in the past, a little under $20 million a year. And now that has grown substantially. And I, for one, don't want the state of Alaska to come up with funding the law that we have for power cost equalization for rural Alaska to come out of general funds. So the question that I have again is, should we change this from the prudent investment rule and go back to get rid of the high risk? Because $200 million reduction in the fund in 1 year is unacceptable to me as a rural legislator.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, thank you for the question. I think this year is one of those years in the history of investing the fund where we had a really negative market. And so we've run into this situation in the past where we have made a switch. I'm sure Senator Stedman will remember when we moved money into the subfund, and we had a horrible year then as well. But in time, over time, investing towards a higher rate of return, because it's a long-term investment, has done well overall. And I expect with the analysis that our investment team does, if it's being managed according to the prudent investment rule, they're looking at the risk that this fund can take in hopes of achieving a higher return. And while I understand how difficult it is to take a hit like that in 1 year, history shows that investing towards this type of return in the end will continue a long-term growth of the fund. No promises, but that's history.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But I, you know, you state that, but we go back to look at the CBR, and it's under low risk. And the benchmarks have been met. And if we kept the power cost equalization in the low risk, we would still have that $200 million in the bank. So I have to question your comments to put power cost equalization under high risk and potentially hope that we come up with more funds. But I don't want to risk the health and welfare of rural Alaska on putting them in a high-risk category. So that gives me great concern. You know, so I think I'd have to discuss this with other rural legislators because we're the ones that are affected. I'm sure that it does not affect you or any of your family, but it affects thousands of people in rural Alaska. And I guess my question to the commissioner would be, can you reevaluate that high-risk situation? Because in years out from Callan and others, I don't feel as comfortable about the markets in the future as you might feel. To lose $200 million in 1 year is staggering. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So I think what we'll ask the commissioner to do is prepare for a future presentation on power cost equalization. And here we have it broken down by year. I'd like it broken down by quarter. And I'd also like to see the asset allocation per quarter and the any monies that, you know, come in or go out. And how the allocation has shifted over time. And then that's kind of the historical view. And then I'd like to also then take a look at going forward with the projections that, you have from the consultants, Callan or whoever. and the allocation that you currently have or and or want to target to have going forward. Also recognizing we've got the draw rate at 5%. And then if you want to propose or have the committee consider what different allocations would look like on volatility. And then we can have that discussion. I'd also like to bring in the point of the 5% payout, because as Senator Hoffman alluded to, the previous 7% payout was too high. It was, you know, going to erode the portfolio, and it would have continually put rural Alaska legislators in a precarious position to have to request additional funding to keep power cost equalization intact. So that rate was moved to 5. And what happens with a 5% payout under different allocations? Because I think that the targeted goal here is to have a healthy and slowly growing power cost equalization and a predictable stream of support to help the communities heat their homes. That's really what we're talking about here. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along the same line, I wonder, there's a significant difference here with PCE as compared to our other endowment style program, use of the permanent fund. This is a 3-year look back for the 5%. If memory serves, the payout. And I wonder if we could also stabilize that somewhat with a 5-year look back.
Yeah. Commissioner?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. Yes, sir. We could put that together. We'll do a robust package and provide this to the committee on how we're going to. So, sorry, for the record, this is Commissioner Designee Crum. We'll add what would a smoothing aspect look like over time, so you can see those proposed items as well as some other allocations and the market assumptions we've been working off of.
And then we'll go to Senator Wilson and Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just also wondering if you know what Callan's projecting for the inflation rate for 2023, and if that's on cue with what you guys are estimating, if you feel that's too high or too low or just right.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, it's going to be around 2.25%, but we'll get those final numbers of what the Callan market assumptions are. Those were
They were actually, this is Pam Leary, for the record. They just came out. They're targeting 2.5% now for the long-term forecast. We're very aware that inflation has been much higher right now.
Yeah, that'll be a discussion when Callan shows up. We've had those concerns at this table for several years on their targeted rates on inflation. Seem a little bit off. And you can't get to the long term if you go broke in the short term. So our time horizon is substantially shorter than the 10-year plan. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, it's troubling, as has been pointed out by the other people at the table, that we're losing roughly 20% of our nest egg that's out there. If that happened with my personal portfolio, I'd be firing that financial planner and looking for another alternative, especially with high inflation rate going on right now. The people out in the villages are certainly feeling the pinch. And I guess my question to you is, how much resistance are we going to get if we decide to go do away with the prudent investment rule and go back to the 5% payout or some percentage of the payout?
Through the chair, co-chair Olson, that is the policy of the legislature. We would activate that as such, sir. So there would be no resistance that way. Was the fund, as designated under the prudent investment rule, is for maximized risk-adjusted returns. And so if the strategy were to change as purview of the legislature, that would be something that the team would work accordingly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just for a finer point, I think the prudent investor rule matches what other institutional investors would do under similar circumstances with similar targets with their portfolio, not the guy on the street. That's the prudent man rule that's on your coffee cup. So I think the discussion may come down to just the allocation of assets. asset allocation, but clearly what I hear from my committeemen is their risk tolerances are different than what is currently targeted. And by ratcheting down those risk tolerances, that would lead to a rebalancing of the portfolio to a more conservative position, heavier in bonds, less on equities, type of thing. So we can have those discussions to, so I think we're not, don't misread the committee saying we're going to, you know, evaluate the performance under some different methodology. We'll take a look at how the performance is relative to the other professionals within the industry, but clearly the risk tolerances here we need to line up. And I think that's the biggest issue here at the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Commissioner Designee Crum. And that's understood. The power cost equalization program is one of the funds in the state that actually directly influences rural Alaskans in their day-to-day lives, whereas a lot of the other funds have much longer time horizons. And so at the department, we do recognize that aspect and the important nature of that and the meaning of what that is. And so we appreciate the ongoing discussions around this.
And when you look at putting the data set together to come back to the committee on the quarterly, again, we'd like to take a look at when the allocation, you know, shifted, how fast it shifted. We've had, you know, challenges with that in the past. We just always want to keep an eye on that issue. Nobody can predict the markets, obviously, but we still want to keep an eye on what's going on there. And then we'll have sounds like Senator Hoffman and Senator Olson would like to have, you know, a little bit of special work done on power cost equalization. I would have to agree. I think we need to take a look at that in more detail. So we'll let you go ahead and put that data set together, and we'll maybe take a look at the draft so we can talk amongst ourselves so the presentation is on point to some of the questions that the committeemen will have, and it'll be more fruitful.
Sure. Before we move on to slide 17, I think I just want to maybe apologize. We talk in all these numbers and high levels about the funds that we manage, but as a team, we talk very much about what service we provide to Alaskans and to constituents. So I just want you to know that we know that these funds are important to all the people of Alaska, and forgive me if we're talking just numbers. We know what the importance of these numbers are, and I just want to share that's something that in the Treasury Division we talk about often. So moving on to slide 17, the Higher Education Investment Fund. So this fund was created in 2012. Its purpose is to pay out performance scholarship awards and education grants. In June of last year, the fund was swept into the general fund. The balance at that time, that cash balance, was $342 million. And so that amount was swept into the general fund, as well as $52 million that came from the CBR due to the investment losses. If you recall, there was quite a bit going on with this fund, with lawsuits and legislation. And so the fund stayed invested the way it was and unfortunately incurred losses during the time before we were able to actually make the sweep in June of last year. HB 322 last year established the Higher Education Fund as a separate fund. And as of June 30, it was reconstituted with the $345 million as a separate fund within the general fund. Also, 7% of the fund can be appropriated for scholarships annually. Moving on to slide 18, this fund is also invested towards a 70-30 asset allocation. It also has a high risk tolerance, long investment horizon. It too had losses resulting in a market value or a return, I should say, of negative 16.19%, pretty much on par with a benchmark. It's targeted for the 10-year return of 5.6%. So very similarly invested to the Power Cost Equalization Fund. Moving on to slide 19, we'll talk about the GFANZI, or General Fund, and other non-segregated investments. The GFANZI has been broken out into two separate funds. We call them GFANZI 1, GFANZI 2. In 2018, the funds in the GFANZI 2 target slightly higher risk return and has some equity in it. Overall, there are 185 funds. They're managed together in the GFANZI 1 and the GFANZI 2, but they're all accounted for separately in the state accounting system. And I'd mention also that at the back of the presentation, there is an appendix that lists the top 30 funds within the GFANZI 1 and with the GFANZI 2, if you're interested in looking at those balances.
So is there any of those funds that the committee should take notice of that are having any difficulty, or is everything just rosy in GFANZI land?
Chair Stedman, unfortunately, I can't speak to that. They're really the purview of the agencies that manage those funds. I will note that in GFANZI 1, the general fund proper, where all the cash goes in and out of, is the largest fund with a $1.7 billion balance currently.
That's fine. That's fine. The deputy, or the, not the deputy, the designee. No, we're not going to demote you. You're stuck with being commissioner designee. If you could take a look at that and get back to the committee if there's any, you know, problem areas, we'd like to know about it. We're not afraid of bad news here. So if there's any not so rosy news, we'd like to know about it to try to deal with it. And if there's any super good news, we'd like that too. So next slide, please.
On slide 20, we're showing the statistics as of December 31st for both the GFANZI 1 and the GFANZI 2. You can see that the GFANZI 1 has a moderate risk level and GFANZI 2 a moderate to high risk level because it has 6% equity as well. The combined total of all of these funds is a little over $4 billion as of the end of December. In terms of the returns, we're at negative 0.28%, so almost not negative for GFANZI 1 and negative 3% for GFANZI 2. But you can see in the six-month returns, again, we're having pretty strong performance for the first 6 months of fiscal year 23.
So these seem to be the same. Are you done with the slide? Okay. These seem to be the same aggregate allocation values referenced in the pie chart with the public school trust, higher education fund, along with power cost equalization. They seem to be the same allocation. Are they all commingled and run together with the same allocation?
So, Chair Stedman, how funds are invested, if you think about and the menu of asset classes that we had, each fund will invest some portion into one of those pools or asset classes. So, for example, the GFANZI is invested 85% in cash equivalents and then 15% in short-term fixed income, whereas GFANZI 2 has 61% in cash equivalents.
Yep. I garbled up my question. It wasn't the GFANZI funds. This public school trust fund in the little pie chart looks like the same pie chart is power cost equalization in the same pie chart as the higher education fund.
Chair Stedman, that's correct. Those are the high risk long term horizon asset allocation that was identified during the process for fiscal year 23 investments. So we have some funds that are at that high risk long-term horizon. We have some funds at moderate, some funds at low risk with shorter time horizon mm-hmm. needs. And so, yes, to optimize how these investments will perform, generally it will target the same asset allocation through the modeling exercise for both power cost equalization, higher education, public school trust, et cetera, yes.
Is there other ones in that group? And you can get back to me on the answers if you don't know, so you don't misspeak, so that's fine.
Through the chair, I do believe that that is it, but I'll get back to you just to confirm.
That's fine. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Leary, just on the previous slide, the slide we've been on here, the Jafonzi 2, I think there was a question earlier about the benchmarks. I think Jafonzi 2 may be the only two rolling periods where we don't beat the benchmark, and I skipped ahead a little bit. I think we've got, 35, 40 rolling periods in this slide deck. Are we using the right benchmarks? I have no doubt that you hire super geniuses exclusively, but that seems almost statistically impossible.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, if you look at the Jafonzi 2, that is one of the performance returns that is just under the benchmark. And if you look at the very tiny footnotes, you can see what those benchmarks are. And so there are equivalents to the asset allocation. They have an equivalent like public, like the Russell 3000 index, which is a very common index that anybody can invest in. That's the benchmark for the equity. So it's those are the public, very available benchmarks that anybody can look to see how our funds are doing in comparison to the market. Did that answer your question?
Mr. Chairman, might be helpful to have just a follow-up conversation afterwards about exactly how we calculate the benchmarks and our targets.
Okay. We'll get into a lot of the benchmark discussion when we get Cal in here. They'll be coming with the permanent fund and also with our retirement system.
Moving on to slide 21, we see the historical assets of the Public School Trust Fund. It's funded by continues to be funded by 0.5% of the state receipts from the management of state lands. It was created back in 1978, replacing the public school land grant that was started itself a long time ago. The fund is now managed as POMV, or percentage of market value, with 5% of the average market value for the 5 years preceding the last previous fiscal year, similar to how the permanent fund is done, but 5%. And the fund is used to provide an offset to the K-12 formula funding. And for fiscal year 24, I believe that about $32 million is targeted in the budget for that amount. Moving to slide 22, the statistics again for December. You can see as of 12/31, the balance is $700 million. This, too, again, is a high-risk, long investment horizon targeted fund for the 70-30 equity to bond investment strategy. Again, over the 1 year, we had negative 16.19%. Compared to the benchmark, which was slightly worse than that. And our fiscal year 23 projected 10-year return target is 5.6%.
Senator Olson, do you have a question before we go to the next slide?
Actually, it has to do with the PERS and TERS. In the recent past, when I first got here, there were significant shortfalls within the retirement system, and because of that, there were large annual appropriations that were expected and done by this committee and the committee and the other body. Recently, this has declined quite a bit. Can you just kind of give us an idea on why and what that was all about, and then what we can, more importantly, what we can expect in the future related to the retirement funds that were in trouble for a while?
Okay, just a second here, because I don't think she's done the slide yet. So let's have her do the slide, and that question might be more on point for the, she can help us with that, but for the ARM board, as far as, because we're going to break down both pensions and health care and the contributions, both past, present, and what we're looking at, what's coming at us, and along with the $2 billion extra dollars you were talking about. So go ahead and do slide, I guess, your next slide, slide 23, I guess.
Through the chair, I will try to give an explanation of that, but let's just look at the graph to start. The slide shows the historical assets for the PERS plan. That one's in blue, so that's the Public Employees Retirement System. It's for both the pension and the health defined benefit plans. There are many other plans in the system, but these are the biggest. And in yellow, it is for the teacher's retirement system, or we refer to it as TERS. It is managed by the ARM board, who's a fiduciary. It's a 9-person board appointed by the governor. The defined pension plans are currently experiencing net outflows from the funds of approximately $1 billion a year. And the 38-year return average for PERS TERS combined was 9%, which favors or compares favorably to our current actuarial assumed rate of return, and that's what the actuaries use when they're looking at the funded position of these funds, and that is a rate of 7.25%, which has been reduced from 7.38%. In terms of the funding and the amounts that have been paid in, I think there are a couple of components of this that the retirement benefit presentation will get into probably a little bit more clearly. But the state is both an employer, so they put in money to the funds for that. And some of the money is now coming from the system, so rather than paying out a check, basically, to the funds, it's coming out in other ways, like through employee payroll. And also the reduction in the amount that is being paid for the second component, the what we call the on behalf of component, which is the amount over the statutorily required, or not statutorily required, but the cap, I guess it is, of what can be put in to the funds from each individual employer. That's what the state is providing. And that number has decreased over the last few years. I know that one component may be something that this committee will be interested in talking about, which has to do with the healthcare plans, which are currently overfunded right now. And the ARM board had set rates, which wound up being a total of 0% going into the healthcare fund. So I think that amount reduced the state contribution levels. But I know that retirement and benefit can state that much more eloquently and clearly than I can.
We have any questions before I fire a few off? Okay. I just like to remind the committee to be very careful when we sit here and talk about the assets, because the liabilities exceed the assets. And I would expect our spread is going to increase from $6 billion some odd dollars total last year to somewhere maybe north of $7 billion. We'll find out when we get it in front of us. But one of the challenges we had almost two decades ago was one group looking at assets and the other one group looking at liabilities, and nobody sitting down looking at them together. So just take what we hear today on this with a grain of salt. We got to look at the liabilities and the matching issue. But one thing that does stick out, I'm kind of curious about, in the 1-year return, the allocation is a little bit different, 80-20, 20% bonds, 80% more aggressive roughly with this, and power cost equalization roughly 70-30 instead of 80-20. But here there was a spread of 4.23% against the benchmark for PERS, almost the same for TERS, so 4% better than the benchmark. Yet when we look at PCE, it was a quarter of a percentage difference between the benchmark and the actual results, both being negative. So PCE was a lot closer to their negative benchmark than the retirement system. And that's a huge spread. And I was wondering if you could comment on why we have would see something like that, why the PERS and TERS system and asset with their allocation wouldn't be more similar to what we would see in the other three, power cost equalization, the school trust fund, and then the other one.
Sure, Chair Stedman. If you look at slide 24, you will see that these funds have a different asset allocation. It is 80%, 20%. But what you'll see is there are a lot of what we call illiquid assets, so private equity, and real estate, which have a little bit of a lag in terms of their reporting returns. And so they have somewhat of a benefit in terms of not having all of those negative returns baked in immediately. But because of the illiquid assets, there tends to be a little bit higher rate of return target. So these are probably targeted at a higher rate than the power cost equalization. And it's just because of the mechanism of what types of funds that they're invested in that the returns are different from power cost equalization or the other funds that are managed more towards public types of asset classes.
So they're not marked to market, is what you're telling us. They're estimated with some accounting process behind them. Is that correct?
That's correct. To get to the values that are there, they're actually there's a quarter lag, but all the cash flows that go into like the private equity, those are there. And so there's a little bit of a lag and delay in terms of the returns being included in them. So they all will get siphoned through. Everything is marked to market, but we have to estimate on a particular day what those values will truly be based on a quarter lag.
Just a final point. I think there's a difference between marked to market on a day of no trading on a weekend versus something that's not traded for 10 years. That's the point.
Through the chair, that's absolutely correct.
So we want to be a little bit cautious whenever we see liquid assets in our portfolios in tough times. Those values are accurately reflected. Senator Wilson, you had a question? Senator Teal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess with an eye toward the caution that the chairman talks about, Ms. Leary, you talked about the Arm Board's recommendation not to contribute the normal cost to the health plans. I understand they're currently, at least on paper, in an overfunded position. Can you, or Mr. Chairman, if you'd rather bring the Arm Board back, talk about the risk of missing the normal cost in a given year?
I think that'll be more on point for the Arm Board, but we're going to talk about that because there was an interest here at the table last year that we kept the same cash flow. And if there's, there was an interest in you know, making sure that the healthcare fund was amply plumped up so we didn't, or we don't run into a situation where we had several years ago, a couple of times where the funding looked adequate. So then we shorted the funding and promptly turned it upside down. So that is a concern. Another question. You'll get off the hook easy on this one. The Arm Board has to field a bunch of questions, you know, and concerns. But we will definitely be taking a look at this. And for those watching at home, I just don't ever assume that there's any issue with the department issuing the retirement and benefit checks, because that is not the case. What we're talking about is managing the portfolio with there's adequate liquidity for decades in that fund. So I just didn't want anybody to jump to conclusions. What we're talking about here is, as accurately as possible, measuring the performance and closing the unfunded liability gap.
Okay, on to section three of the presentation, the final section, to talk about state cash flows. My annual caveat that all of the fund balances that we saw previously are cash balances versus the accrual balances. And I just wanted to state that again for the record so that we know what we're looking at versus what gets talked about for the budget or in the comprehensive financial report of the state. Slide 27 is a picture of the cash inflows and the cash outflows of the state and how everything comes through the Treasury Division through cash management. So all the tax revenues from oil and gas, corporate, other federal dollars, any kind of receipts from fees that agencies collect, and then money goes out for education payments, payments for paperclips, Medicaid payments, debt service payments. Everything goes through the general fund in and out and then eventually goes to its resting place, whatever fund that might be. On slide 28, we talk a little bit about the money coming into the funds. On the revenue side for unrestricted general fund, it's a fairly strangely even split for both petroleum revenues, about 47%. That's projected for fiscal year 23 in UGF, and 47% of investment earnings coming primarily from money from the permanent fund. And one thing to point out with this revenue is that for petroleum, there's uncertainty for in-year receipts, so we don't necessarily know what we're going to get through fiscal year 23. But for the investment return, we know pretty much because of the PMV calculations how much money we have for fiscal year 23 and for 24 due to the lagging formula. But that uncertainty, of course, goes through fiscal year 25 and beyond. Slide 29 talks a little bit about expenditures. One concept that we talked about earlier on is the fact that we have mismatches in cash flow timing and has caused us to borrow money from the CBR in the past. And that can be because certain federal programs require you to pay before you recall the money from the federal government. We have beginning of year appropriation transfers that come from legislation that was passed, and the finalizing of a prior fiscal year all happening in the first 2 months of the fiscal year. So we have like state pension payments and transfer to sub funds for programs. And also summer is kind of a peak year for projects and money being spent from the state. So there's a lot of money going out in the first 2 months and not so much coming in. So there's a little bit of a timing mismatch between revenue and expenses. So cash flow deficiencies. Historically, we had most of our money in the general fund, and over time, we've had other funds that take away money from the general fund proper and put into pockets of either designated or restricted funds to be used. So our cash available to pay day-to-day operating costs has been somewhat constricted over the years and continues to be. However, we have typically had language in the budget bill that allows transfers from the CBRF if unrestricted revenue is insufficient to cover the general fund appropriations in a given year.
Okay, but done on that slide, we do not have that this year. We don't have what we call backfill language. That would allow that vote, or not that vote, but that door to automatically open to the constitutional budget reserve, that takes a three-quarter vote in the budget process. So that is unavailable as we sit here today. And if we get halfway lucky, we won't need it between now and the end of June. We'll see. I would like to just make one other quick note. That's something that we'll have to talk about here at the committee, is how we want to structure backfill language again in this year's budget. And we'll go over all that just in case we do have a shortfall in FY24. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That brings up the question, as we get closer to June 30th, we still have the 4 months here and we'll have a better idea, but what does the administration plan if that happens? Are you going to try to address that during this session with the three-quarter vote, or if we run into problems, are we going to be called back in late June?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Hoffman, this is Commissioner Destiny Crum. This is going to be, as we continue to monitor the situation, particularly on the volatility around oil commodity prices, if we think that's going to be an issue, we will be in close contact with the committee on that, on how this would work out and how much do we think we project we're going to need.
My question was primarily regarding time frame.
Through the chair, Co-Chair Hoffman, at this point in time, to what Chair Stebbins alluded to, we are looking like we're going to be in good shape. This is going to be, if there's something that happens, world events change or the commodity prices fall off drastically, it'll be an immediate conversation. At this point in time, we are projecting that we are going to be able to make sure we're sufficiently funded throughout FY23, but this is going to be something we're consistently monitoring.
We have also asked for a review of negative appropriations, Senator Hoffman, that we'll talk about. It's a tool that we have at the table to reduce this year's appropriation requests, to try to not have a crisis in the end of May when we're done with our budget and we find out we can't make payroll in the middle of June. We don't want that to happen. So we'll be having those conversations here also on how to protect ourselves from that, because as Senator Hoffman pointed out, we want to do our budget. We want it on time, on balance, and we want to go home. We don't want to be here in June because we created a financial bonfire. We collectively, the administration and the legislature, without pointing to one body or the other or the third floor. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With all due respect to you, especially Mr. the Commissioner, I guess you're more optimistic than I think maybe reality, as we look at some of the tumult that we've just gone through with the organization of the other body. Getting a three-quarter vote is going to probably be just as impossible this year as it was last year. And so if we have to dip in there, as was pointed out, I would anticipate we're going to be not just dependent on what the price of oil is going to be. We're going to be dependent on what we come to in a special session, which none of us want to have happen, especially during the summer, but it's just the reality.
So we'll be constantly asking OMB and the Department of Revenue to keep us advised on the position of the current year's budget as we approach, especially when we get into March and we start finalizing our budget. But we are looking at what negative appropriations we can implement if need be. And they are not the elimination of the Marine Highway System, so, or the university, or anything like that, so, or PCE. And we're actually looking at, for those so they don't jump to conclusions, we're looking at negative appropriations that are basically harmless, relatively minimal to no impact. Okay, go ahead and continue.
Thank you. This is a perfect segue to talk about cash deficiency and the memorandum of understanding that we have with the Departments of Revenue, Law, Admin, and OMB, we all have outlined the steps. So the first and foremost is we monitor our cash on a daily basis. We see what's coming in and out compared to our projections. If we see that we're going to dip below the threshold, which is still $400 million, which is estimates to be about two perfect storm days of having to pay out everything that we need to pay, payroll, pension, et cetera, we call for money. Historically, we've called from the CBR and the earnings reserve, and that is another source of revenue coming into the general fund this year. And that will be obviously something of interest that we look towards next year too as well. And if we have any indications that we're not going to be able to make our cash and or budgets, we will either perform temporary fund borrowing, but really that has to be paid by fiscal year end. If it's something that is going to be more like a revenue shortfall, we will, through the governor's office, seek legislative action to see what we can do in terms of identifying additional funds. And if all else fails, we start prioritizing disbursements and restricting expenditures, which I think only one time in the history have we actually almost come to that point. And that's when there was a restriction on what could be used by the general fund way back when.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's been some time since I addressed this issue, but can you give my office the authority for temporary fund borrowing from the CBR and the ERA? I'd like to look at those provisions again. Thank you.
And if you could get that to the chairman, and we'll, I guess there's three of them here, but just get it to the committee and we'll dole it out to everybody. The sacred cow that wasn't mentioned was the fallback to the permanent fund and the earnings reserve account. And that's in, I think, that document. And we can actually bring that document to the table and talk about that. We should understand that as we spend through our liquidity, the CBR and the SBR, which is statutory budget reserve, which is for all practical purposes zero, and then the constitutional budget reserve that's sitting at about $2.3 billion estimated. So the concern that I have, my constituents have, is going to the earnings reserve account of the permanent fund, the cash flow of the state doesn't pass the red face test. When we started out a few years ago with $17 billion on the sidelines. So I don't get excited when I even see that in the document. Because once we start relying on that to make payroll, next thing you know, the sacred cow is going to get slaughtered. And we're even going to have a bigger mess to deal with. But let's have that come forward in a future meeting when we, after we start putting our budget together and we get a better look at our financial position, maybe after the spring forecast or so. But we should review that document. And also in reviewing that document, I think it would make it aware within the building that it even exists. A lot of new members probably don't even know it. It's even such a waterfall process to finance the state. But with that, I'd like you to just touch on a little bit what we did with the permanent fund and sending the funds to the state. I think that's been smoothed out. And can you help us with that a little bit? The 5% portion that comes?
Yeah, certainly. So there is the smooth out percentage, 5% of the PMV, as you said, and that has been split for this year, I think half and half going to pay dividends as well as the other half, about $1.6 billion to the general fund. We have not called any of that money yet. Is that what you're speaking of? But we intend to, as cash flow dips or starts to look like it needs additional funding past the $400 million balance.
Yeah, it wasn't really the question on the split. I think there's substantially more than a 50% going to the dividend in the proposed budget, quite a bit more.
This year, yes. Mm-hmm.
But the question was the timing of the 5%, $3 billion or whatever it is from the permanent fund 3.6 coming, the timing of that to the Treasury. You just don't one day get a check for $3.6 billion. I think there's some smoothing that we worked on here at the table with the department to help the agencies and our help your cash flow.
Chair Stedman, that is true, particularly in fiscal year 20 and 21. Last year, we actually were able to manage without getting the money until the end of the year to support the finances in those first 2 months of the fiscal year. This year, I think we'll be a little bit different, especially with the general fund transfer to the CBRF, but we just don't know when we're going to hit that number yet. We haven't really projected when that transfer is going to happen. So it'll be we're in the second half of the year, so we expect it in the next 6 months.
Okay, maybe you can, when you get back to the committee, maybe you can help us with that, how the timing of the cash flows into your department help smooth out the call to the Treasury to make sure you have ample resources. Any other questions on slide 31, I guess? I'm one page behind. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Leary, on this slide, so the target is a $400 million minimum. Is that a fixed number? Is that meant to be a little less than a month of UGF spend? What's the origin of that number?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, it's about 2 days worth of having to pay out all of our bills at once. Payroll and pension payments, they're high numbers. And because we don't have any, there's disparity in terms of the days sometimes that the amounts come in. So we give ourselves at least 2 days worth of money to be able to pay those amounts. So we project what our cash flow balance will be. And if we see it start nearing towards that $400 million, we ask for more money from whatever sources are available. But we try to manage our cash fairly closely.
So if we get down to $400 million, we're in trouble. That's the bottom line. We can't hardly even make payroll. So that's just unacceptable outcome as far as I'm concerned, to even get close to that. And that's a policy call I think we make here at the finance table. And I think when we go through our budget process, it would be nice for us to make a recommendation to the administration on what we feel is the minimum cash balances. Because once you run out of cash, oil prices go down, you might as well turn the light switch off. And that's no way to run a state. So it's nice to know the bottom line number that you need, but we want to make sure that you're not laying awake at night worrying about making payroll, which many, many Alaska business owners do from time to time. And anybody that's been in that position knows it's no fun to be there. So let's come up with a better solution here at the table.
Moving to slide 32, I won't belabor this. We've talked about much of this before. Just some notes on when the CBRF was fully repaid by fiscal year 2010, but the borrowing from the CBRF commenced in fiscal year 14. And if you recall the chart, you see how much had been borrowed. As of the fiscal year 21 ACFR, the financial report for the state, there was $12.8 billion owed to the CBRF, but the fiscal year 22 ACFR is expected to have a reduction in the amount owed due to the transfer for both the sweep of assets and other items.
Okay. Senator Hoffman, do you have any comment on the CBR being repaid in 2010?
It's good times.
Well, I think several of us were at the table and in the building. And it was nice to see the CBR paid off. I don't think, unfortunately, we're going to live long enough to pay off the $4.8 billion. It was substantially less than that, or $12.8 billion, substantially less than that when we paid it off. But it is, and those who are watching at home, there is no payback period, and there is no interest accumulation. But any excess funds in the state at the end of the fiscal year, if there's a debt, automatically go to the Constitutional Budget Reserve because there's a debt. Last year, this committee decided that we didn't want that to happen. We wanted it to go to the SBR, the Statutory Budget Reserve, that takes a simple majority vote to ensure that in an event that financial circumstances turned against the expectations, that we would not need a three-quarter vote and we would not need to reconvene the legislature to finish the current fiscal year. That is why we took that position. Now, that's different than the executed or implemented budget. That was changed by the administration. But that was a policy call this committee made, referencing back to the earlier comments by Senator Hoffman, the need for a potential special session along with Senator Holson. So we will have those discussions again and see what the committee decides in the budget process.
Slide 33 outlines some volatility management techniques that we have used and hope to use in the future, including borrowing from other funds, managing the timing of ERA transfers to the general fund, managing the timing of expenditures, which we have done throughout the years. We have, for example, the education fund used to get paid at the beginning of a fiscal year, but they didn't use that money. It's managed in the same format in the Javonsi, so we've been paying that money out on a monthly basis. That helps with our cash flows. Also, in the last session, there was a bill to help modernize or add to our fiscal tools, including a line of credit to the revenue anticipation notes. So those are some ideas that have been thrown around in the past. I'm sure that there are others that are being thought of. Slide 34.
Well, back on 33, I think the position that the Finance Committee took was not, there wasn't a lot of an interest in revenue anticipation notes. There was a huge interest in accumulating a cash position. So I will be surprised if the committee wants to strip the state of cash and then rely on revenue anticipation notes to make payroll. So we need to work on that issue, because there is concern that that's the slow trajectory we've been on. And we tried to turn the position last year around, and we're in the same position today, roughly, than we were a year ago. And it's not going to take much of a downdraft in oil prices before we have serious financial strains on the state, because we don't have $12 billion in the CBR anymore. So don't expect a warm reception to structuring the state to run without cash reserves and to go to the financial markets and make payroll.
Slide 34 is my final slide. Just some takeaways in terms of the cash flow process. We know that our forecasting, it's pretty much always wrong, right? We try as best as we can, but things happen. And luckily, we manage that on a daily basis. If we have improper assumptions, our shortfalls may occur, and we need greater cash reserves as revenue volatility increases. We do have volatility management techniques, and we hope to implement them continuously throughout the next fiscal year. And thank you for your time and letting us present.
Well, it's good. I'd like to see the higher revenue volatility requires greater cash flow reserves, and hopefully we'll be getting a lot of support from the other body and the administration as we try to, you know, protect and insulate the state from that as much as possible. I'd like you to take a few minutes, Commissioner Designee, to talk about the periodic meetings you have with your staff on how you make decisions, and because of the immense authority that the Revenue Commissioner has. I know we talked about that in my office, so it's not a surprise question. And some of us here at the table have talked about it several times over the years. And different administrations do it a little differently, so we'd like to hear a little bit about how you handle that.
Well, thank you, sir. Mr. Chair, for the record, as Commissioner Designee Crum. So one of the aspects that's important to the Department of Revenue is we do this quarterly investment review period, upon which we meet with the Treasury staff and the other items, the other groups that we have prepared, to make sure that the risk profiles, the asset allocations of which the commissioner is the primary fiduciary for, is the most prudent response, that we are doing what is necessary based upon the risk profile that's been determined and where do we stand. And so that is an ongoing meeting that occurs across the board. We also meet regularly with the other items and responsibilities we have within the department, such as the tax division and other groups. And so we have a biweekly check-in with each director at this point in time because of ongoing application period for the permanent fund division. That is a weekly check-in to see where we are at with both the backlog and previous year applications, as well as status of current cybersecurity issues and eligibility applications of what's going on now. And so we do these regular meetings and updates to make sure that the commissioner's office is apprised of any ongoing concerns and or adjustments that need to be made, both from recommendations from staff as well as concerns we hear from the legislature and or from the governor's office.
And I would thank you for doing that. I know some commissioners have done it different in the past, and I think it's good that you have a review committee just as a sounding board. And then, you know, nobody expects you to make the correct decision all the time, just the best decision with the information available at the time. We never know what's coming around the corner in the financial markets. So that's appreciated by the committee that you do that, because it's not recognized by many people, the authority, the vast authority that the Commissioner of Revenue has. It's substantial under any circumstances, and there's billions of dollars at stake and the health and of the financial health of the state. So that's why I thought I'd ask that question. I thought he might toot that horn here during his presentation. I kept waiting for him to throw that on the table, but I wasn't going to let him get out of here without talking about that.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. We did make sure it was a bullet point, but I think we'll probably make that its own slide later on so people can understand the deliberate process upon which we go through. That as we look at each of these, and as you've noted throughout some of the stats, that there's different risk profiles and time horizons for each one of these big, large primary funds. And so that changes how they may be asset allocated across the board. And we want to make sure that we are doing this on a very prudent basis, that this is the expertise both internally with our investment officers and also taking information that's broadly available. When the Alaska Retirement Management Board meets, they've got their actuarial consultants, their statutory investment advisors, as well as the investment consultants. And so all of that information is used in presenting information on a macroeconomic scale, and that will advise and influence how different investments are made within the state, within the Treasury Division, as well as the public meetings that the Permanent Fund Corporation has. Their groups are out there talking. So we're taking in all of this information to make sure we're doing this. I take that fiduciary service is one of the highest levels of service there is in law. And so it's something that is a very serious responsibility. We want to make sure that everything is done as transparent as possible.
Mm-hmm. And just one final comment. I thank both of you for coming forward today. And I think the department has run well, and the performance relative to the market conditions that they have to deal with is good. We just need to make sure that we create good policy direction. Because if the ship's going to sink and we tell you it's sink, when we go to blow holes in the bottom, there's not all the pumping you're going to do to save it. So our job is to make sure that we give you the right direction to go down. There's not much of a question that you won't execute that direction soundly. So we look forward to working with the department on the cash flow issue of the state and the red face test on that. and then also with the power cost equalization. We worked through that, and maybe we could come up with a different risk profile for you to deal with. We'll do that together over the next couple months, and then work also on the projection of the next 2-3 years of power cost equalization, because it's a matter of people heating their homes. Any other questions, comments before we finish today? Okay, that concludes the meeting today. The next meeting tomorrow, 9 a.m., SB 40, FY24 operating budget. We're going to have the Office of Management and Budget Director, Neil Stanninger, who's been here many times, start walking through the budget. So we'll reconvene 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. Thank you very much. We are adjourned at 10:40. We're adjourned.